this week, the Masonic philosophy of George Washington. In previous episodes, we've explored George Washington's religion and certain notions of the Founding Fathers. In this two-part series presented this week, we'll dive even deeper. Then we'll read a 25-year-old article published in the Washington Post about Washington, D.C.'s map from Satan to the Sphinx, the Masonic mysteries of D.C. In this article, the author traces the various claims of notable and influential Americans to crackpots and more when referring to the various claims of occult and Masonic designs within the city of Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. Finally, we'll wrap it up with a discussion on beginning new spiritual paths and manifestations and what that has in store for us. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 556. Since July of 2011, this podcast has been bringing Masonic education to anyone interested in the royal art and its kindred sciences. No small endeavor, requiring hours of work each week on top of what we all have. Kids, spouses, work, all of these things. I wanted to take just a moment to thank our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners for assisting us in bringing this Masonic Education podcast to the masses for 10 awesome years. So I want to thank you guys all very much for your continued support. And if you're interested in supporting the WCY podcast, please visit our website at wcypodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. Additional options are, of course, we have a shop where we sell some limited edition items, including our producer's pin, handmade bespoke leather keychains, books, and other things that will surely interest those interested in Freemasonry. We've also got a bookstore where you can check out the books that are recommended, including my personal recommended reading and listening lists, books by those who have been on the show, and books recommended by those people who have been on the show. All great books, and they're all linked back through Amazon, which means if you buy these books through our links, a small portion of each sale comes back to this program. So we thank you in advance. In the news, of course, you probably heard if you listened last week that I was unable to make the super amazing South Pasadena Masonic Lodge MasonicCon event. And it hurts my heart that I missed it. But I got to see some really great and amazing posts from people who did go. It looks like it went swimmingly. If you'd like to hear more about it, Brother Dago Rodriguez, one of the architects of the event, happened to be on, I believe we did, episode number 391 just this last Thursday on the Masonic Roundtable. And you can check that episode out. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can find it with ease. As far as the presentation schedule is concerned, of course, we are through most of July, which means the next thing I've got going on, really, is I'll be doing a virtual event sponsored by Vista Lodge, number 687, called Finding Truth, How to Conduct Masonic Research. I'll be doing that on August 10th. August 22nd, I'll be doing The Secret of Adam's Grave. And, of course, August 27th, MasonicCon Kansas. You can get those tickets for MasonicConKansas.com/shop. Now, I think what I should tell you is I believe they are all sold out of their Founders Club pass. So what's left, I believe, is a general admission and virtual. And it's a great deal for virtual. I think it's $15 and you get a whole day of events. And then there's MasonicCon South that was just announced not too long ago. The speakers have been coming out. They released a video just recently featuring everybody who will be at the event. Looks to be awesome. John Ruart, Jason Richards, myself, Joe Martinez, P.D. Newman, and the always awesome Most Worshipful Brother Sean Bradshaw. It's sponsored by the North Carolina Research Society and looks to be a great time. All right, let's get into the education this week. We've got some things that I wanted to cover last week, but I didn't want the show to get to be like 2 hours or something, so I kind of split it up. And so the first thing I'd like to get into this week, I would like to read a two-part series called The Masonic Philosophy of George Washington, Part 1 and 2. This first part was published on the Midnight Freemasons, as was the second part, and part one was also featured in the July issue of the Lyceum, the education publication of the Grand Lodge of Illinois. I will go ahead and run part two in August. And here we go. The Masonic Philosophy of George Washington, Part 1 by James E. Fry. My brethren, the subject of Masonry and its connection to the Founding Fathers and the American Revolution has inspired much research and heated debate. The progression of history has accepted the craft as a mere footnote in the events that led to the founding of our great nation, when in actuality the Masonic Philosophy was a driving force behind the social change of the Enlightenment era. Masonry and its rich ideals and virtues changed the social consciousness of the founders to accept social justice, not only as an inevitability, but as a duty they owed to God and the common lot of humanity. They accepted the responsibility of bearing the sword of justice and the torch of destiny, and stood strong against the tyranny of kings and monarchs. The Founding Fathers were really rebelling against the claim of a man that it was the will of God that he is ordained to rule. The founders saw the darkness of this system, that it was based upon ignorance and fear. Their goal was to lift humanity toward the light of political liberation and democracy, as they also believed it was the will of deity to institute this change in history. The Grand Lodge of Massachusetts addresses the Masonic influence in the American Revolution when they write to George Washington on December 10, 1792. Quote, "A band of brothers, having always joined the acclamations of their countrymen, now testify their respect for the milder virtues which have graced the man. Taught by the precepts of our society, that we, all its members, stand upon the level, we venture to assume this station and to approach you with that freedom which diminishes our diffidence without lessening our respect." End quote. Out of all the Founding Fathers, no man is more revered in American Masonry than George Washington. In fact, he was almost dubbed the title of Grand Master General or Grand Master of North America before he declined as an act of humbleness. Washington has become an almost archetypal figure of Masonic and American character. He stands as an ideal, a symbol for the courage to fight for freedom and not to accept the whims and dictates of those who claim authority not given to them by the consent of the people. But what were Washington's true feelings and thoughts on the craft? What were his concerns on the new nation he forged out of steel and bullets? Washington was a strong proponent of the Masonic philosophy, and how it helped shape his character into the strong leader that we venerate as a champion of liberty. Washington addressed the nature of a true Mason when he wrote back to John Cutler, Grand Master of Massachusetts, on December 27, 1792, quote, "Flattering as it may be to the human mind and truly honorable, that the milder virtues of the heart are highly respected by a society whose liberal principles must be founded in the immutable laws of truth and justice. To enlarge the sphere of social happiness is worthy the benevolent design of a Masonic institution, and it is most fervently to be wished that the conduct of every member of the fraternity that discover the principles which actuate them may tend to convince mankind that the grand object of Masonry is to promote the happiness of the human race." End quote. Washington addressed the philosophical mind state of a Mason as being concerned with the virtues of the heart. A Mason should have a strong sense of compassion and mercy toward his fellow man. We can see this concept echoed in the Masonic teachings of charity and relief. That is the position of a Mason, to relieve the distress of those who are afflicted by strife and to offer a hand of charity to help those who do not have the needs to stand for themselves. This sphere of social happiness is the sphere in which this philosophy spreads into the national character. Washington also addresses that this sphere must exist upon the backbone of truth and justice. This truth and justice is the foundational belief that all men are created equal. It is not wealth of privilege that creates a higher class of citizen. This was the belief of the world. In the new world, the virtues of the individual would be the basis for social esteem. So this sphere of happiness could not exist without the old system of belief in government. So it is the true duty of a Mason to shield the oppressed and stand up for justice and truth. a Mason shall not stand idly by as his fellow man is exploited by the privileged and powerful. This is the benevolent design of the Masonic institution that American government implemented, that no one could rule without the consent of the ruled. Those who are self-serving will not exploit us as people. A true leader, like a Mason, is interested in the welfare of others and will stand in defiance of tyranny and injustice. It is these ideals that are instilled into every candidate upon the checkered floor, the nature of both good and evil. Washington believed that this new form of government by the people for the people was the great social change that Masonry offered the world. It was the great plan implemented that, when established, would inspire the rest of the world to throw off the chains of monarchy and take up the cause of truth and justice. Paul Revere, another famous American Mason and founding father, addresses this Masonic plan when he was Grand Master of Massachusetts, and he wrote to Washington on March 21st, 1797, quote, "Of these Masonic teachings, may you partake in all their purity and satisfaction, and we will assure ourselves that your attachment to this social plan will increase, and that under the auspices of your encouragement, assistance, and patronage, the craft will attain its highest ornament, perfection, and praise. And it is our ardent prayer that when your light shall be no more visible in this earthly temple, you may be raised to the all-perfect lodge above, be seated on the right of the Supreme Architect of the universe, and there receive the refreshment your labors merited." End quote. Revere discusses how if a man takes in the Masonic teachings in purity and without polluting the truth and universality of it, you will understand that this social plan of the Masonic character is assured to be just and true. Revere believed that the craft would reach its apex of influence when all its members adopted this plan to indoctrinate Masonic values into the American character, thus creating a nation of the highest virtue and moral culture. Revere uses Washington as an example of how his Masonic character is a shining beacon of light that we must all adhere to become like. Washington responded to Revere on April 24th in 1797 and further addresses the Masonic character as being selfless in nature. He claims the true reward to the Mason is the betterment of himself through his morality, bringing himself and society closer to God. Washington writes, quote, "No pleasure except that which results from a consciousness of having, to the utmost of my abilities, discharges the trusts which have been reposed in me by my country, can equal the satisfaction I feel from the unequivocated proofs I continually receive of its approbation of my public conduct. My wish is that bounteous providence will continue to bless and preserve our country in peace and in the prosperity it has enjoyed, will be warm and sincere, and my attachment to the society on which we are members will dispose me always to contribute my best endeavors to promote the honor and interest of the craft." End quote. In this, Washington shows that American character should be self-sacrificing in its display of justice and charity. He says his fullest reward of all his earthly labors is that the all-seeing eye of Providence has blessed their endeavors to liberate mankind politically, thus reflecting honor and the interest of the craft. In this statement, he expresses his belief that God has blessed the Masonic agenda of social justice to establish a new form of government, and that is the duty of Masonry to aid in the American destiny of the liberation of humanity. This is the proper attitude of a true Mason, to do what is right and strive to benefit others with no hope of monetary value and reward, only that honor be reflected upon the craft and society profit through God's will. So as we look upon the Masonic character, what do we see? From the writings of Revere and Washington, we see a man dedicated to serve and protect others. A true Mason understands how the ideals of the craft can change the character of not only an individual, but also a nation. If the Founding Fathers had not held these virtues and ideals so close to their hearts, in what kind of a nation would we live? Would they have proclaimed themselves rulers to satisfy only their own self-interests? Would they have exploited the people to benefit only themselves? It is a scary thought to think that the American principles could have never existed, but it was the belief of the Founding Fathers that the virtues and ideals of the Masonic institution were an intricate part of the destiny of mankind and the will of God. So when we as Masons lost sight of those truest of virtues, when we join a group for only a lapel pin, or we step outside the length of our obligation, let us remember that the virtues we enact are a central part of God's plan to liberate mankind from the darkness into the light of individual duty and justice. Let us learn from the example of the Founding Fathers, who resisted all temptation to oppress and exploit, but to remain steadfast to the virtues of the craft and to the obligation that makes good men better. James E. Fry. All right, no doubt that was fantastic. Let's check out Part 2. Again, The Masonic Philosophy of George Washington, Part 2, Founding Principles, a second part of a series by James E. Fry. In August 10, 1782, Washington wrote the earliest surviving exchange of his Masonic correspondence. These early letters were with his brother and friend, Alcina Watson, presenting him with a specialized Masonic apron symbolizing the Union of France and the newly formed Republic under the all-seeing eye of Providence. This apron is now in possession of Alexandria Washington Lodge No. 22, Alexandria, Virginia. In his memoirs, Brother Watson states, quote, "Wishing to pay respect to our beloved Washington, I employed in conjunction with my friend M. Cassol, nuns in one the covenants at Nantes, to prepare some elegant Masonic ornaments, and gave them a plan for combining the American and French flags on the apron designed for this use. They were executed in a superior and expensive style. We transmitted them to America, accompanied by the appropriate address." Men and Times of the Revolution, Elkanah Watson, 1856, page 135-136. Watson Cassol wrote, quote, "In the moment when all Europe admired and feel the effects of your glorious efforts in support of American liberty, we hasten to offer for your acceptance a small pledge of our homage. Zealous lovers of liberty and its institutions, we have experienced the most refined joy in seeing our chief and brother stand forth in its defense of a newborn nation of republicans. Your glorious career will not be confined to the protection of American liberty, but its ultimate effect will extend to the whole human family, since Providence has evidently selected you as an instrument in its hands to fulfill his eternal decrees." January 23, 1782. Masonry was the product of the Age of Enlightenment, an era of political and social upheaval focusing on the things we take for granted today, such as inalienable rights, democratic government, and more. This focus on reason rather than religious tradition is based on alchemical and Rosicrucian teachings which spawned in the Dark Ages, propagating an evolution in science, influencing philosophers such as Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, and those in German existentialism. This focus on reason and understanding is what transformed a union of laborers and craftsmen into a society that would reshape the face of Western culture. The Masonic philosophy was different depending on which part of Europe your lodge was in. This difference in philosophical emphasis is also what accounts for the main differences between the Grand Lodges of England and the Grand Orient of France. American Masonry, with its emphasis on liberty and individual rights, grew out of the Grand Lodge of England, which was primarily influenced by the works of John Locke. Locke is known as the father of classical liberalism and British empiricism. Locke was one of the most influential of the Enlightenment thinkers. Locke's theories and contributions to classical republicanism greatly influenced the Declaration of Independence and the structure of the American government. Locke's focus on Western and religious tradition as a detrimental part of who we are as a person and where we are going is what greatly separated him from the more radical thinkers of his time. This is reflected in the implementation of Greek and Roman mythology in the early artwork and architecture of America. Locke also introduced the idea of a separation of church and state and its relation to a social contract, which greatly influenced the Founding Fathers. Locke believed that people in a state of nature would defend and care for each other without government protection, but they would have no guaranteed protection of their rights and would live in constant fear, so people would willingly come together to form a state. This state would act to protect the lives, liberties, and properties of those who lived within it. Unlike social contract theories, before which claimed the right of the government came from the authority, Locke claimed that the right of the government to rule came from the consent of those who were ruled. these moderate views by today's standards were revolutionary at the time and were the main political foundation of American Masonry. This influenced the Founding Fathers to create a national character which respected liberty as well as religious beliefs of others. The Masonic respect of all religion was what set American and British Masonry apart from French Masonry. This is primarily because of the works of Jean-Jacques Rousseau and its influence on the French Revolution and the Grand Orient. Brother Rousseau saw the Enlightenment period as an overthrowing of the religious establishment. Rousseau had little respect and admiration for traditions and Western religious values. He saw the Enlightenment as a dramatic change in the social consciousness. Rousseau believed liberty was possible only if it were the direct rule of the people as a whole in lawmaking. But Rousseau did not believe people understood their quote-unquote real will, so they could not rule themselves within the confines of their social consciousness. Rousseau believed that a just society could not come about until a great leader or legislator arose to change the values and conceptions of the people. He believed a true will of the people cannot exist when focus is placed on the individual, so the people must subjugate themselves to the laws of the legislator. By this, Rousseau understands that the laws and subjecting to laws are an expression of freedom. Quote, "Each of us puts his person and all his power in common under the supreme direction of the general will, and in a body we receive each member as an indivisible part of the whole." End quote. It is not a stretch to understand how the American Revolution, as influenced by individual sovereignty, was a just war, which led to a true republic as opposed to the French Revolution, which was a bloody and violent revolution that eventually led to the dictatorship of a tyrannical rule under Brother Napoleon Bonaparte. I believe this is why the founders would not militarily aid France in the Napoleonic Wars. They saw how Masonry was corrupted from within by radicals, which eventually led to the destruction of over half of Europe. Washington addresses tyranny and evil in his response to Watson thanking him for the apron. Quote, "If my endeavors are to avert evil with which this country was threatened by a deliberate plan of tyranny, should be crowned with the successes that is wished. The praise is due to the grand architect of the universe, who sees fit to suffer his superstructures and justice to be subjugated to the ambition of princes of this world or to the rod of oppression in the hands of any power upon earth." August 10, 1782. This trend in the differences of philosophy and political consciousness is relevant to understand the development of the Masonic philosophy. The original Grand Orient of France claimed responsibility for the French Revolution and enforced an atheistic and secular view of Masonry, which led them to being derecognized by the Grand Lodge of England. This is the difference of the Rousseau influence on Masonry, which denounced religion, and Locke's influence, which respected religion. Under the reign of Napoleon, not even the Grand Orient was safe, as it was institutionalized into the regime only to merge with Ecossais Rite in 1804. It is interesting because, as we addressed in part one of this article, Washington believed that the American character should be a selfless individual dedicated to serving humanity and God. This spirit-centered approach is what I believe to be the foundation of Masonry and America. This foundation is what led to success for the colonies while France fell to tyranny, rejecting the spiritual nature on humanity. To understand the evolution of the Masonic character, we must look at the origins of the philosophical foundations of modern Masonry. Masonry is referred to as a progressive science, but I beg the question, are we still true to our original intent and mission? George Washington and the other founding fathers valued the deep philosophical nature upon which the craft was founded. We have forgotten our roots to Rosicrucianism, alchemy, and the Enlightenment philosophy. In fact, most members that we have raised in my lodge in the past few years have been mostly self-serving, interested in wearing a ring or making a corporate connection. Lodge meetings have become nothing more than a reading of minutes and small-minded bickering. This new corporate Masonry, quote-unquote, has watered down the average Mason's understanding of philosophy, ritual, and even the seven liberal arts and sciences. How have we allowed what was once the great influence of the Western world be reduced to a marketing tool which raises dozens of Masons who get a ring and never set foot into an officer's chair? In my personal opinion, I believe the Founding Fathers would be disappointed by the state of Masonry. There is no focus in finding quality members and to further enlighten them. We have lost sight of our true purposes to make those business connections or pushing an agenda to mainstream and washed-down version of the craft? But why? Why change years of tradition for this corporate masonry? You cannot market masonry to my generation by what is popular in the media or in the movies. Masonry is a calling, in which, like men, are drawn to a path of light and hope. Men are born masons. We choose to walk the checkered tile when we are ready to emerge from the darkness. I feel masonry has lost its mystery and allure, and as a younger member, I feel my generation is willing to work for our degrees, to learn Latin phrases and memorize their meanings, to discuss the philosophy and origins of the craft, to learn full-form catechisms. We wish for a return to tradition of our past brothers. I know a lot of Masons are afraid. There is a lack of membership. Lodges are closing. It seems as if Masonry is no longer important to the American character. But trust me, if you focus on the right members, the quality of members who are willing to work for their Masonic experiences, they will appreciate it more and get active. So let us return to our traditions. Let us remember the Masonic character of our founding fathers. Let every Mason know that Freemasonry is the foundation of the American character and the philosophical tool for bringing humanity out of the dark ages and into the light. Quote, "No people can be bound to acknowledge and adore the invisible hand, which conducts the affairs of men, more than the people of the United States. Every step by which they have advanced to the character of an independent nation, thus supported by a firm trust in the great arbiter of the universe, aided by the collected wisdom of the Union, and imploring the divine benediction on our joint exertions in the service of our country." Washington, Inaugural Speech, April 30th, 1789, by James E. Fry. For the Craftsman Plus, I'd love to know what your thoughts about George Washington as a philosopher may have been, or any other of the Founding Fathers. I think we all knew that George Washington was a Mason, so I'm glad we didn't belabor the point too much in the episode. However, all solid information. Now, the next piece that I wanted to read for you was pretty interesting, and it was published a long time ago by Mr. Charles Paul Frond, for the Washington Post, no less. And the title of the article is, "From Satan to the Sphinx, the Masonic Mysteries of D.C.'s Map." Now, we've all seen some crazy specials on any number of channels like Discovery or History Channel or H2, or maybe you watched some kind of backwoods documentary on Amazon Prime, or maybe you read the book that Chris Hodapp did about all the symbolism of Freemasonry and whatnot that stands within our nation's capital. However, this piece was pretty cool, and from a non-Masonic perspective on some of this that was published again by Charles Paul Frond in the Washington Post back in November of 1995. Seems like just 10 years ago for some of us, but this was indeed 25 years ago. From Satan to the Sphinx, the Masonic Mysteries of DC's Map. The map of Washington, the story goes, encodes certain secret symbols of Freemasonry, symbols that go back for centuries, if not entire millennia. Symbols, moreover, that if properly decoded will reveal a cryptic history, not only of the capital, but of the country. And not only a hidden national history, but a hidden destiny as well. That there is something suspicious, or at least suggestive, about the city's geometry has been rumored for a very long time. No doubt since the heyday of anti-Masonic paranoia during Andrew Jackson's administration. Now, with the explosion of popular interests in conspiracies and the occult histories they necessarily imply, such claims are again growing in number and volume. Indeed, an apotheosis in this genre was reached at October's Million Man March, when Louis Farrakhan, standing on the Capitol's west front, told a baffled national audience that the Capitol, the Washington Monument, the White House, and the whole of the city's monumental core had been quote-unquote placed and based in a secret Masonic ritual. Farrakhan went on to sprinkle his extended remarks liberally with references to Masonic initiation rites, numerology, Egyptology, and other arcana. When it comes to the national capital map, however, the patterns that may have been traced into it by Freemasons, there are other thinkers whose visions either complement or compete with Farrakhan's, and, in the interest of context, these two bear examination. A word or two of initiation. Masons have a confused place in the national imagination. To many, they are charitable, fun-loving lodge members who engage in odd but harmless fraternal rites. To some, their secrecy is suspicious. To a few, they are Satanists, working to destroy Christianity and take over the world. A handful of non-members identify with their precepts. Although many of the nation's founders were Masons, including George Washington, Ben Franklin, Paul Revere, and all the participants at the Boston Tea Party, there has been a persistent conspiracist underground that for 200 years has regarded them as a front for some other force. The Bavarian Illuminati, the International Jewish Conspiracy, pagan devil worshippers of Atlantis, etc., which seeks to undermine American institutions and sovereignty. Currently, there is a large and ever-increasing library of new anti-Masonic literature that associates them with the godless New World Order that purportedly threatens the country's independence and its citizens' freedoms. The evidence that Washington, D.C. is now and has ever been in the grip of this conspiracy is, according to these authors, plentiful. This includes, above all, the particulars of the Great Seal pictured on the back of the dollar bill, with its undeniably Masonic symbolism of an unfinished pyramid, the all-seeing eye, and the Latin motto that translates into New Order of the Ages. Even the number of feathers on the eagle of the seal's obverse has been linked to the number of degrees in the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. That the seal appeared on the currency during the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, a 32nd degree Mason, and the purported prime mover of socialism in America, is said to be no coincidence. Many details of the city are cited to demonstrate an ages-old, un-American, un-Christian allegiance of the national leadership. That the Statue of Freedom atop the Capitol faces not west toward the rest of the country, but east toward Egypt and Persia. In one such sign, that the monument to George Washington is an Egyptian obelisk is another. That the cornerstones of many government buildings, including the Capitol, were laid by Masons in full-aproned regalia performing mystifying Masonic rituals is yet another. Clinching proof of conspiracy is that the patterns of the Capitol's very streets conceal Masonic shapes, symbols, and signs from all but a knowing, if not all-seeing, eye. The simplest version of the Masonic map theory is the claim that the mall is laid out so as to replicate a Masonic lodge, and at a glance, at a typical floor plan of an 18th century lodge quickly suggests where the idea could have come from. There is an apparent affinity of form. According to Masonic histories, the shape of a lodge had been largely standardized by the time Washington was laid out in the 1790s. It consisted of a long rectangle positioned east and west, with a tapered but unfinished triangle at the eastern end, where the quote-unquote furniture, compass, square, and Bible would be found, and where the master would officiate. This does not necessarily describe a building, by the way. Lines on a floor would also constitute a lodge. That's essentially the mall. It's a long east-west rectangle with an unfinished triangle at its east end, formed by the convergence of Pennsylvania and Maryland Avenues at the foot of Capitol Hill. Where the master would stand, stands the Capitol. Certain details are absent, but other important Masonic shapes can be located on the mall. An aerial view of the Washington Monument and its circular walkway, for example, provides the point in the circle, a multi-layered symbol in Freemasonry's speculative and mystical side. Of course, circles, squares, rectangles, and triangles are not hard to find on any city map, especially Washington's with its Baroque-inspired design filled with circles and radiating boulevards. But the presence of these shapes at the very heart of power is not coincidental to a suspicious observer, especially one familiar with the importance Masons place in shapes and their symbolic significance that they have attributed to them. Masons maintain that though their lodges can be dated only from 1717, Freemasonry actually developed out of the medieval builders' guilds. Accordingly, they are thus keeping alive a tradition that is not only responsible for the sacred architecture of Gothic cathedrals, but also an inner doctrine of symbolic geometry that they say dates all the way back to the construction of Solomon's Temple. This doctrine regards the character of God as that of the great architect, and of builders as potentially doing God's work, though that would depend on the purpose, shape, proportion, and harmony of their creations. This is an abstruse doctrine, but one with a long history. Its origins lie in the mystical Pythagoreans of ancient Greece, who believed all of creation was continuous and could be expressed in numbers. Musical octaves, for example, are produced by striking strings whose lengths are in whole number ratios. Eventually, the Pythagoreans were confronted with heretical irrational numbers, which they apparently attempted to suppress. Related doctrines were at large in medieval times. The Benedictines, for example, are sometimes credited not only with building their monasteries according to sacred geometric principles, but even of pitching their chants in harmony with the architecture. Gothic architecture is, of course, replete with complex geometrical symbolism. Bernard of Clairvaux is said to have expressed its underlying concept in the 12th century when he asked, quote, "What is God?" and answered, "He is length, width, height, and depth." Renaissance Hermeticism was obsessed with grasping the harmony of creation's ultimate continuity. The occult means it used for the purpose sacred geometry, numerology, Kabbalah, alchemy, magic, etc., became, as scholar Francis Yates has demonstrated, the foundation of the scientific revolution. But the point of this ages-old search was to apply the underlying mechanics of cosmic harmony to man and his worldly works. Thus, a building designed according to such principles is not merely a building, it is an inspired and, in a sense, a living thing, resonating with the cosmos. And if that could be true for a building, it could be true for the ideal city, if only such a thing could be designed and built. Which brings us back to Washington and the mysteries of its design. The obsession with geometrical forms to be found in the works of speculative Freemasonry is an echo of this tradition. Though no one knows how it came to be part of Masonic doctrine, Freemasonry's ultimate origins are a matter of complete confusion, with at least a dozen competing theories in circulation. Still, if one concludes that there is a lodge traced into the mall, it is not merely a matter of a floor plan, whether sacred or profane, it would be a lodge. But lodges are not all that interpreters of the city's map have discovered there. There may be two ideal cities traceable within the profane city limits. In 1989, Michael Bagent and Richard Lay published a work entitled The Temple and the Lodge, which sought to demonstrate that Freemasonry evolved from the 14th century wreckage of the Knights Templar, a crusader group of immense wealth that was accused of heinous blasphemy and suppressed. Their concluding chapter is a Masonic history of the American Revolution and ends with a design of Washington, D.C. According to them, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson intervened in Pierre L'Enfant's work of laying out the city so as to impose a pair of octagonal shapes around the Capitol and the White House. Bagent and Lay, who cite no sources for their assertion, write that the intervention of Washington and Jefferson would produce specifically octagonal patterns incorporating the particular cross used as a device by Masonic Templars. End quote. Actually, it's well known that Jefferson, who is not known to have been a Mason, wanted the street pattern of the federal city to be a simple grid. He hand-produced a grid layout of the city before L'Enfant was assigned the task and complained to the Frenchman about all of the diagonal avenues he was planning. Anyway, it was not octagons that interested 18th century revolutionaries, it was circles and triangles. James H. Billington, writing in Fire in the Minds of Men, describes at length the connection between the concepts of Pythagorean order and of revolution that developed during the period. Quote, "However bizarre it may appear to later revolutionaries and historians alike," writes Billington, "this Pythagorean passion seriously influenced the organizational activities of the first revolutionaries." End quote. According to Billington, revolutionaries of the period combined their political thinking with geometry. Odd though it may seem, it was a case of Pythagorean simplicity, warning against Rococo absolutism. Revolutionaries signed their names with geometric shape. Ruminations about the social and political implications of the circle and triangle may be found in the period's revolutionary works, including that of the notorious Adam Weishaupt, founder of the very Illuminism that still figures in the nightmares of modern conspiracists. This state of mind may appear incomprehensible today, though it is worth remembering that Isaac Newton had earlier established the foundation of modern scientific thinking at the very time he was trying to map the typography of hell. In any event, all of this political geometry is entirely germane to both the geometry-minded Masons who were in the thick of the international revolutionary underground of the period, and to the mysteries of the American capital's map, which is, after all, overflowing with both triangles and circles. As for the octagons, if they are indeed carved into the city's street pattern, they would point not to a revolutionary ideal shape, but to a different but related ideal shape, the eight-sided ideal city of Vitruvius, the first century BC architect whose work became an essential influence on early modern architects. In Vitruvius's time, the ideal city could only be imagined. Any effort actually to build one would necessarily fall short. His octagonal city, by the way, is based on the belief current in antiquity that there were eight winds. An effort to incorporate the concept of Washington's map would represent a notable effort of intellectual imagination. Are these octagons there? No, at least not where Bajant and Lay assert they are. They do provide a map purporting to show how the streets around the Capitol and the White House encompass the shapes. But if the rule is that there actually must be streets where purported shapes are to be found, then their map falls short. Farrakhan, for his part, is interested in none of this. He's interested in Giza, Egypt, the site of the Great Pyramid, and the Sphinx, which he believes that the nation's founders as Masons have purposely replicated in symbolic form in downtown Washington. The Jefferson Memorial is the Sphinx, Arlington Cemetery is the Valley of the Kings, etc. Expansion on his references to the city's mysteries can be found in the Million Man March Home Study Guide Manual, published in advance of the march. There he provides a map of the mall, revealing the hidden pyramid that can be found by drawing lines connecting such major sites as the Capitol, the White House, and the Lincoln Memorial, among others. However, LaFont, who placed both the Capitol and the White House on their respective sites, is not likely to have in mind their relation to the sites of the later Lincoln or Jefferson memorials. If for no other reason than that in the 1790s, when he was working, the sites of both memorials lay in the midst of the Potomac mud flats. A century was to pass before those locations were turned into dry land. Farrakhan, it should be noted, strongly approves of the secret Masonic designs he perceives in the city's map because he believes the Masons to be serious adepts of Islam. That is also why derivations of the number 19, important in Islamic numerology, can be found all over the monumental core. It is in fact possible, in some sense, to Islamicize the Masons if you connect them with the Templars, because the Templars are said to have maintained cordial relations with Muslims, especially in Ismailis, during their long crusader sojourn in Jerusalem. Indeed, they are said to have been influenced by certain Islamic and Judaic doctrines, and to have evolved a mysterious secret doctrine on which much ink has been spilled based on those influences. Such scholars as Peter Partner dismiss this tradition as nonsense, but that is the folklore. Farrakhan's view is not based on this connection, but rather on the fact that one kind of Mason, the Shriners, wear fezes and refer to Allah in their rites. Rites which were created in the 19th century. The Home Study Guide Manual refers to all Masons as Muslim sons, or Muslim sons. Notes that many presidents have been Masons, and states that, quote, there are many others in high places who know and recognize the identity of Master Fard Muhammad, regarded as the promised Mahdi by the Nation of Islam, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and Minister Louis Farrakhan, end quote. Farrakhan's position that the Masons are Muslims is shared by the Free Masons Ministries, located in Washington State, though they do not all approve of this. To this ministry, Islam is a form of paganism, the Masons are serving the devil, and the streets of Washington are the Masons' secret tribute to Satan. To demonstrate this, the ministries published, quote, Freemasonry, Satan's Door to America, question mark, end quote. A pamphlet distributed in the late 1980s included in this work is the single most spectacular map ever drawn of the secret shapes discernible in the Capitol streets. Not only is there the usual Mason's compass and square, there is an entire pentangle traced out, focusing on the White House, and a satanic horned goat traced around the Capitol. Most impressive of all is that the shapes offered follow actual city streets with a minimum of rounding off and cheating. This map is the work of a man named J. Edward Decker, who writes of the secret shapes that he is as much impressed by, the audacity of the thing, as the conspiratorial nature of it. Decker notes that the inverted pentangle is an instrument used to conjure evil spirits. And, citing a colleague whom he identifies as a quote-unquote former Mason and former Satanist, he argues that this design, quote, is a spiritual door to the occult, a planned invasion by the powers of darkness, end quote, and that the nation has, quote, been under siege from the first day our first president walked into the Oval Office, end quote. When Jefferson warned LaFont that he was drawing too many diagonal avenues into the city's plan, diagonals that created all these angles and triangles, and that crossed in traffic circles, he likely did not have these problems of Masonic perception in mind. Jefferson believed right-angle grids were rational and that LaFont's many diagonals were troublesome and arbitrary. LaFont went ahead anyway, not because he was a Mason, but because, according to the classic account, he was much influenced by the Baroque layout of Versailles. His converging avenues have nothing to do with Pythagoras, and everything to do with the three-road Pâté d'Oie, enabling a viewer to command an impressive vista. LaFont has been criticized for this, since the inspiration was absolutist and its application to a democratic capital is questionable. As architect Paul Spurgeon put it in a 1963 critique, quote, "The whole plan of Versailles focused on the bedroom of Louis XIV. What could that kind of plan mean symbolically in the United States?" End quote. But who sees Louis XIV at the convergence of Pennsylvania and Maryland Avenues? Almost nobody. Not when there's so much to distract one. Compasses and squares, the Great Pyramid, and horn heads of Satan and ideal cities where once there blew only the Potomac winds, all eight of them. Charles Paul Frond writes frequently for Outlook. Well, there you have this informative article that went through many of the different conspiratorial designs that people say are laid into the Capitol, including this eye-opening account of the speech and apparent guide that happened at the Million Man March with Louis Farrakhan, which is a very interesting yet misinformed viewpoint, if I do say so. And I do say so. I do think that there is an interesting layout that has happened in Washington, D.C., and I think it is not something that was planned from the beginning, but was planned as it happened over the years. I do believe that there is something there that can be laid out that I'm not sure has been laid out before. I have talked about this in episodes past with Brother Frodero on the program that you may or may not remember, and I've created my own maps with overlays and things. But to that end, I guess I'll stop talking about it there. I don't want to get too conspiratorial here. I did find it of somewhat of a hilarious nature. The use of the word occult as always seems to be, you know, this satanic thing that people cannot get over. I don't know why it's used that way. I had to laugh at a lot of this, and I loved the way the author closed it out, talking about where only once there blew the Potomac winds, right? Because that was all that was there. And then he says all eight of them, referencing the eight winds earlier talked about in the article. All right, to close it out this week, we're going to do a single card tarot draw and look at a little bit of symbolism contained within. And this week I'm going to use just the standard size Smith-Waite deck, a borderless deck. And we'll do our little disclaimer here that the way I'm going to use these cards is not divinatory. And let's face it, you know, tarot has nothing to do with Freemasonry, but it has some commonality in that Freemasonry asks you to better yourself using the working tools of Freemasonry, which are allegorical in nature, and tell you to use those tools on your conscience to become a better human being. And part of this is the idea that you need to reflect on things. And that is largely the role of tarot, is a reflection. And so it is in this way and how we're going to use them. If this is your first time listening, this is what we're going to do, is pick one card out of the deck. We're going to look at its prescribed meaning. So exactly what Waite wrote about the card itself. And then we'll extrapolate it a little bit. And if we can, we'll relate it back to Freemasonry and see how this particular card, what it could mean for us in a practical sense in today, and how it aligns with Freemasonry and becoming a better you. So let's do a quick shuffle here. This deck is a little bit larger, so I do split it into two piles. People have asked over the years, when I do readings in person or online, if I have a specific way that I shuffle the cards, and my answer is no. I just try to clear my head of intent, make sure that I am giving the meaning of the card as I want to give the meaning in its most objective way without assigning any meaning to it for the individual who's in front of me. What I mean by that is I don't want to influence you. I want to tell you about the card, and then I want you to tell me why it could be relative to you. And this kind of is pulling the string, and then I'll ask more questions and tell you more about the card, and then what happens is you have your own sort of revelations. And that's why tarot is so popular, and why tarot readings are always so on point, because they're for you. Right? It's not us telling anything about the future or anything else. It's allowing us to assist you in pulling things out so that you can be ready for them or take action on things that you're basically being asked about that you hadn't thought about asking of your own self. We'll go ahead and pick one card. I'm just going to fan them out. And for the benefit of those people who are in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group, as always, I will post a picture of the card, which, you know, I want to really quickly mention, I had not been doing. And a brother said, hey, it would be really cool if you started to post a picture of it. And so I thought, you know what? That's a great idea. So we've been doing that ever since. So if you've got a great suggestion for the show, please let me know. All right. So the card that we've got today that I just drew is the Page of Wands, but I also drew it inverted. Wands, a seemingly masculine card, is dealing with manifestation. So you've got the page, who is the lowest on the rung of court cards. So you've got the page, the knight, the queen, the king. The page is just lower than the knight. So the page is like, you know, the sword boy. I don't know if you remember that from Army of Darkness. But anyway, so the page is the lowest rung here, and he appears in a desert, and he's got his wand, and he's kind of staring at it, and he's almost studying it to think about his innate ability to use the wand. And so perhaps this card is about the realization that you can do things, that you can manifest things by the use of your personal skills. And the page also wears a hat, and he's got a little red feather in it. You can tie the red feather back to something like the Phrygian cap that's always like typified in red. As he stares at the staff, right, he is admiring the leaves that are growing out of it. He's got salamanders that are all over his tunic. And the salamander is described as a mythical creature, but a salamander is a real creature, so it's not really mythical, is it? It's a creature associated with fire and transformation. Think about if you have kids and you saw Frozen, there's that salamander, right, that has the ability to use fire. But the page is just hanging out. And he's got both feet are on the ground, so he's firm, he's grounded, right? He's not, you know, launching himself into the ethereal realms of Kabbalistic thought or anything. He's being real. But at the same time, I mentioned that, you know, you're at the beginning stages of realization, your ability to manifest or take control of situations. The page is really inspired by the growth that he sees on the staff. And in the background, right, is like this desert and the mountains. And what's interesting here is this is speaking to a person's ability to find value where none exists. So he is a individual who is in a barren landscape who has found and appreciated something. So looking for the good in all situations? Yep. Looking for opportunity where seemingly there is none? Of course. And the ability to find value where others might not necessarily see it. Absolutely. Now, the card we drew was reversed, actually. Now, it doesn't mean that everything I just said comes down to a negative on this part. However, it just means that you might be a little bit confused. It suggests that all of these things I mentioned apply to you, that you have this great ability to see the good in people or the good in a situation or the opportunity where none seemingly exists. But maybe you're not really sure how to start. You're not really sure how to start a project or to talk to a person. You might have the inklings of a new idea or even a premonition that something is going to happen. But you're spending too much time worrying about your inability to get it moving or to do something about it, and not enough time just doing it. It's important to, in the creative process, not to force anything. It's important to surround yourself with creative people and influential ideas, sure, but don't force the thing. The card also could mean, and I say could because it's not always true, but perhaps in the mind of the people who you're doing a reading for, and in this case, the listeners, and myself as well, the card could mean that we tried new things or projects that just really didn't turn out the way we wanted them to. Maybe you started a new job and it didn't exactly line up to what you were hoping it would be. But the card itself is not telling you to like reminisce on these bad things. It's actually saying maybe just because you didn't get it that time, it doesn't mean that your thoughts on the process are wrong or the thoughts that you had are wrong. Like if you wanted to start, let's say, a new business and you kind of failed at doing something, maybe you wanted to be a new web developer and you launched a new website or a new web service and it didn't take off as planned. It doesn't mean that that idea was trash. Rather, it means that maybe just the execution was out of alignment. The card can also mean that you might have a great idea and you just don't know where to start. You see this a lot in Freemasonry. We've got officers who are ready to take the East or even the Grand East, or perhaps you've got brothers of a lodge who are contemplating new ideas to make the lodge updated or fun or start new traditions. But the complexities of beginning something new in an organization that sometimes takes a little bit of extra help to get things moving has become daunting and you just don't know where to start. This is letting fear and anxiety getting in the way of your ability to begin a thing. And so the first step I would say, especially for our Masons out there who are in this realm, is to talk to the officers. Finally, this particular card sometimes comes up in a reading when somebody is beginning a new spiritual path. So this looks at the card in a little bit more of an esoteric fashion, right? The wand is something as manifestation or magical or even spiritual. And page, being at the beginning of the court, is low on the totem pole, representing the beginning of a journey. And so in this sense, it could be that you've started a new system. Maybe you've joined a new quasi-Masonic order, a new initiate, if you will. Perhaps you have joined a new denomination of church. Perhaps you've started seminary somewhere. You've started a new spiritual journey that this is just calling out to it and saying, stay the course. You're part of the discovery. It's going to be an inspirational and intense spiritual path. And because it's inversed, it means you're keeping it private. And that's okay. Well, that's all for this week. I want to thank our producers, fellows, and contributors one more time. Without them, we cannot bring this show to you. Those are the people who financially contribute to this program on a monthly basis. And again, they make it all possible. So thank you so much to all of you. If you're curious, like what the benefit is, aside from the feel good that you're bringing the program to millions of people worldwide, yeah, I do send you a few cool things. Put your name on the website as a contributor. If you're a fellow, I do that. Plus, I send you a nice little thank you card in the mail. And if you're a producer, I do those other things. Plus, I send you a producer's pin. And then, of course, we've got our legacy partner, which is the extraordinary, where we work with the legacy partner to produce a full episode of their choice. And we work very diligently to put together interviews or whatever we need to do for an entire episode of the WCY podcast on a topic of your choice. And it's been a lot of fun to be able to do that. Last year, one of our legacy partners, Christian Stebbins, who is a tremendous force for Freemasonry on the East Coast, put together an awesome interview opportunity with Brother Frank Conway, who's the author of the only Scottish Rite Northern Masonic Jurisdiction text on the degrees that is sanctioned, we'll say. And we got him on the program, and it was an awesome interview and a video as well. So you can actually find that on YouTube. I'll put a link to that one in the show notes. I think it's a fantastic episode. And the Masonic Pageant is a wonderful book as well. Anyway, if you're curious, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can assist if you so choose. I also just appreciate anybody who's out there and likes and subscribes to the YouTube channel, or shares the videos, or shares the episodes with their friends and brothers. We'll talk to you all next week, and until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You? I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
Yeah.